We have to be prepared for the fact that they're not going to always want to work on our terms like they did when they were little. And we're still going to need to want to, you know, make it work and work with their terms and not take it personally that they don't want to work on our terms, not insist that they talk when we feel like talking, not insist that they answer the questions that come to us. We need to actually be more flexible and amenable to connecting in the ways that they have in mind.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Abby. And as women, we are constantly comparing ourselves to others. But your life isn't supposed to look like hers. Being your best self means standing firm in your decisions and always being willing to grow with a purpose.
We get vulnerable and real with an honest look into the challenges and triumphs we all face. Every woman listening gets the opportunity to choose what life looks like for herself. We're really excited for this episode today because we're bringing you something that we haven't really in the past. Today, we're going to talk about adolescents and even teenagers, including some really hot topics like when we give a cell phone. So our guest today is Dr. Lisa Damore. She's a mom of two daughters, a psychologist, and the author of three New York Times bestselling books that help parents untangle family life. She graduated with honors from Yale University and worked for the Yale Child Study Center before earning her doctorate in clinical psychology at the University of Michigan. She knows her stuff. She's been doing it a long time, and Abby and I felt like this conversation gave us so many answers to questions that we're already starting to think about. Enjoy the episode. As we were just chatting about off air, we're starting to think about our young kids getting older and eventually becoming adolescents and teenagers. We want to start to lay the groundwork for how they can be resilient and cope with the challenges that come with those years. How can we start to do that?
Well, you know, it is so wonderful to be with you. I really appreciate you inviting me on your podcast. And I love that you're starting to think already about what it means to raise teenagers and have teenagers. I think the first thing that we want to say is that adolescence begins at 11, which is a lot earlier than people think. I think everybody feels like, oh, 13, because of the word teen at the end of 13. But we have always, as psychologists, marked the onset of adolescence around age 11 because we tie it to puberty. And even if you can't see outward signs, most kids, boys and girls, kids of all genders, are underway with puberty by 11. And so what I would say is it's not as far away as a lot of people think. And then in terms of laying the groundwork, there are a lot of things you can do. One is to just have a lot of conversations about feelings, be, you know, ready to put words on feelings and model good coping. That's something that you can do more easily with young kids when their emotions are still somewhat quiet compared to adolescent emotions. The other thing I will say is that when kids are between the ages of 6 and 10, we call that phase of development latency because like they're really, really ramped up. Emotions are kind of quieter. And 6 to 10-year-olds are a blast often. Like they are super fun. And one of the ways you can think about making the most of that is, first of all, just enjoy your kid a lot. You know, that they think we're funny. They want to go to the grocery store with us. They enjoy our company. They, you know, they want to do things with us. The other thing you can think about is you're putting money in the relational bank with your kid. And ultimately, even with 6 to 10-year-olds, but certainly with teenagers, one of the ways I was taught by a supervisor when I was in my training is you write your disciplinary checks against that account. And what I mean by that is part of what helps kids do the right thing, you know, behave in the way that we hope that they will, is that we're a lot of fun when they are doing what they're supposed to do. And we want it to feel to them that it comes at a cost to upset us, or it comes at a cost to rub us the wrong way. And so that's one of the ways that actually you help kids like make good choices, is that they know that when I'm, you know, doing what I'm supposed to and kind of minding the lines, my folks are a lot of fun. And I don't want to risk that by doing something I'm not supposed to do. And it's in sometimes, not always, it can be a little bit easier to have fun with younger kids. They're more into it maybe than your teenagers are. So take full advantage of that when you've got younger ones.
Amy and I both have kiddos that are six, almost seven, first graders. And I see that. Like, I can see Lucy, she just loves me so much right now. She writes me birthday cards weeks ahead of time. She'll like tell people like, my mom and I, we did this. And I remember saying it to one of my friends saying, oh my gosh, she like loves me so much. This is so fun right now. And instantly what came out was, hold on to it. Because just wait when she's a teenager. And it was in this condescending voice. And I like how you said it, Lisa, because you were so kind about it. You're saying, enjoy this. Use this as currency. Like, use this as a way to build up the relationship. And it's just this positive way of looking at it when I think a lot of people out there look at it in a negative light.
I think it's true. And I think I hear that too. You know, I hear, as someone who cares for teenagers, you know, and families, and I've done this for so long in my career, you know, it's been so often when I've, been with like an audience and then a parent will come up to me afterwards and they'll say, you know, my kid is still 11 or 12 and we're getting along. Like, I think we're going to be okay. You know, and I can hear underneath there is like this, she's not going to dump me and be nasty like those poorly parented teenagers out there, you know? And I sort of feel like, wait, like it's not personal. It's not personal. And I think that sometimes when you hear that edge in the parent around like where it's headed, I think that it feels more personal than it really is. It is the job of teenagers to become increasingly independent. And we actually want this for them, because unless we do want them to live with us forever, which I don't really think most of the time we do, right? We want our kids to get ready to move out eventually. And that's a big project to go from what you're describing of your six-year-old who is so in love with you and so adores you and would take everything you've got in terms of time to a kid who's 18 and ready to leave, you know, to either, you know, enlist, enroll, or be employed. That's 7 years with a very large transition, or well, 7 years from the start of adolescence with a large transition. So they become more independent. That's not a rejection. That's them trying to do their job.
Our listeners are already learning so much just in these few short answers here, but I want to tap into something that you said on CBS Mornings. You mentioned that the most powerful force for mental health in adolescence is strong relationships with caring adults. We've got to meet them more than halfway.
Yeah.
So when you said this, what did you exactly mean by this? And also, how can we meet our kids more than halfway?
So first of all, adults matter tremendously to teenagers. They matter to little kids, but it's sort of more baked into a little kid's life, you know, that they are reliant on us and spend a lot of time with us. And I think we can wrongly assume that, you know, teenagers just want to be with one another and they don't care about their relationships with adults. Teenagers continue to really value and want strong relationships with their parents. And then on top of that, as they loosen those ties and get ready to move on, they strengthen their relationships to coaches and teachers and mentors and bosses and people running their after school drama clubs. You know, I mean, the value of the adults who surround teenagers, whether they are parents or not, like I cannot overstate. But especially at home, and especially in light of what we were just talking about, teenagers are not always as amenable to our overtures as they used to be, right? So your little kid, you're like, you want to go to the grocery store? They're like, yeah. You know, your 14-year-old, they'd be like, why would I do that, right? Like, why would I ever go to the grocery store with you? And yet later in the day, the 14-year-old, when you're not in the mood to talk, may be entirely ready to talk. I hear this all the time. I see it in my own parenting. I have a 19-year-old and a 12-year-old daughter. And so when I said you got to meet them more than halfway, we have to be prepared for the fact that they're not going to always want to work on our terms like they did when they were little. And we're still going to need to want to, you know, make it work and work with their terms and not take it personally that they don't want to work on our terms, not insist that they talk when we feel like talking, not insist that they answer the questions that come to us. We need to actually be more flexible and amenable to connecting in the ways that they have in mind.
I am finding this so interesting because even as we parent our younger people right now, you know, you start to realize like you can't always force them to behave a certain way. And it sounds like that's good practice for what's coming up. Abby's husband and I were having a conversation recently that surrounds this next question because our middle little guys were getting ready to play soccer. some of us have those kids where self-esteem can be a struggle. And then you put them in an activity like sports or even in school, and you're worried about how that's going to go because, you know, the truth is maybe they're not going to be good at that. Do you have any advice for how we can help our kids develop solid self-esteem, even if they aren't one of the stars?
Oh, absolutely. So let's start with the stuff they're good at. Right? It's a pleasure to do the things one does well. It's easy to feel good about them. And I actually think we should make sure that every kid has something that they're doing where they enjoy a strong sense of mastery, right? So some kids get lucky and their, you know, school is right down the middle of what they're strong at. And so then they get a lot of mastery at school. Some kids are highly athletic, you know, so they go out for sports and right away they get a lot of good feeling that comes from being good at it. You know, so if you happen to have a kid who thrives in those conventional ways, like it's just more convenient for you. But I think there's, you know, all kids are good at something, and we need to make sure that they feel that they can enjoy their skill sets. And it may be hobbies, it may be service, it may be working. I mean, kids take tremendous pleasure in earning money, right? And having jobs. And that's something that can happen. Maybe not necessarily money for little kids, but like kids like to feel useful and important. But then sometimes there's the kid who, you know, you're like, you're going to do a sport. Like that's a value that we have as a family. Like we want you out running around, and they go out for the sport and they're really into it. And then suddenly it happens sort of awfully soon with sports. Like teams are split and there's the A team and the B team, and your kid is lucky to get on the B team, and it starts to become searingly apparent to them that they are surrounded by kids who have skills that they don't yet have and actually may never have. This is a really, really valuable moment in parenting. I think it's actually more valuable than when kids are thriving, because your kid will be upset, especially if they start to really get it. You know, there are a lot of kids who are middle of the pack or, you know, bringing up the caboose who don't realize that. But then it eventually dawns on them. And usually developmentally, it's somewhere around third or fourth grade where kids start to become much more aware of, bluntly, you know, rank in something, you know, and where they rank. And then they get very upset at times. And then they will at times want to quit. And let me tell you what the tempting answer is, and the one I have felt tempted to do as a parent. And I totally understand if parents have gone here. And then let me tell you what I would recommend in its place. So the tempting answer is to say, oh, you're so good at soccer. I don't think the coach really sees it, you know, and you're also better than that other kid. I noticed that thing you did. And to try to build up the kid's self-esteem by reassuring them that they're actually great at this thing. This is, of course, like, who wouldn't want to do this? Because it's awful to see your kid in pain. I'm going to give you the alternative answer and I'm going to tell you why it's the one I prefer. I think the alternative answer is to say something like, you know, it's true. There are kids who are right now stronger at this than you are. And this is something you're going to run into your whole life, no matter what you do. Even if you're really the top of the pile for a moment, it only lasts a moment. There's always people around us who are incredibly talented, incredibly skilled. You never get to be the best forever. And very rarely do you even get to be the best. And then while being completely relaxed about it, say, and this is not a problem. This is not a problem at all. Here's why we surround ourselves with people who have skills we do not yet have, may never have. They make us better. So I want you to start to pay attention to the kids around you who have skills you don't yet have. See if you can figure out what it is they're doing, how they're getting there. You know, they may be practicing a lot more than we're practicing. They may be, you know, thinking about this a lot more. See if you can get there. You may never pass them, but being in their midst and watching them carefully, that's going to help you grow. And that's what we're here for. We're just here to grow. And then the other thing you can add on is you can say, and listen, I got to tell you, like, it's great when you're like crushing it at school and getting straight A's, like school comes to you relatively easily. You know, let's say that's an example here. I think that's terrific. I'm much more proud of you for sticking in with soccer. It's hard to stick in with something that does not come easy to you. And so just so you know, I'm impressed by what you can do at school. I am enormously proud of your willingness to keep at it with soccer, even when it's not coming so easily to you. And I hope you're proud of yourself too. So like, that was a very long answer, but I just think like, these are choice moments to set kids up for the principal idea, this critical idea that effort and outcome are connected. If you want to get better at something, you often have to work at it. And peers who are highly talented are there to inspire us, not to humiliate us.
I'm tearing up listening to that answer. Oh. I was not expecting to have that reaction, but it was just, I almost was thinking of it, speaking to like the former version of myself. I never heard words like that. Mm-hmm. Like those words, I don't know if it wasn't just part of our school culture or my family culture, but it just, you've said it so eloquently and in a way that, yes, it's so true. Like there's always going to be somebody who's better than us. And that's not a problem. Like that is the whole point of this, is to get a little bit better, and you don't have to strive to be the best. And I think like as a perfectionist, always wanting to be the best, even as a 4-year-old girl in soccer, was always the dream. It was always the goal. And knowing that that doesn't have to be the goal. You can always try to be better, but not necessarily be the best.
Absolutely. And it's a setup. It's just a setup to put that as the target. Cause like, of course the kid's going to fall short. And even if they're great in one league, they're going to be bumped up another and be, you know, not so good in the next league. And I remember so my husband and I are both, you know, academics in our own way. And we've got kids who like school, like they're school kids. I mean, they're just straight up school kids. And it's, you know, just, it's just the luck of the draw that they are. And I remember when my older daughter was doing, I think it was middle school soccer. And I said to her, I'm so glad you're not the top of the pile here. Cause like, what would push you? What would push you? If you were, you know, and I think, you know, just really normalizing, like those kids were so skilled, like, you know, try to catch them. You won't, but you'll get faster.
Let's take a break from this episode to bring up our partner, Vuori. Vuori is such an amazing brand. We have been familiar with them for years now. And when they came to us to be a partner, it was a no-brainer. There are several styles that we cannot live without. You most likely see Amy and I in our Halo Performance Hoodie 2.0. I think we each have 4 different colors. And the whole Halo line between the Essential Bra, the Essential Tank, as well as the Essential Hoodie, they all are top-notch material, so soft, and wear after wear, wash after wash, come out looking brand new. Everything about this brand, we have just been so impressed with. They're the only jogger that I love. So the performance jogger or the weekend jogger, both A+ options in my book. But don't just take our word for it. There are countless 5-star reviews, including hundreds of Herself listeners who have bought and loved their products. So if you go to VioriClothing.com/herself, you do get 20% off your first order. Again, that's Vuori, V-U-O-R-I, clothing.com/herself for 20% off. Can't wait to see what you choose.
And now a quick break from our sponsor, Gooder. So I have to tell you guys a story. We were at Trey and Micah's soccer practice the other night, and all 4 of us show up in our Gooder sunglasses. This is how much the Keepers and the Greens love our Gooders. And you know, they're easy to love. They fit well. They look good. They are just the perfect sunglasses. Our favorite is the Back 9 Blackouts, which are just classic. They look good on men. They look good on women. Just a nice sunglass to have around. So if you want to join our crew, you can go to gooder.com/herself and use code herself for free shipping. Again, that's gooder, GOODR.com/herself, and use the code herself for free shipping. And now back to our show.
I like that you just brought up school, because that's the good part about school, is that it does push us. But then we also know that a lot of our kids are going to start to develop some really strong negative reactions to school as well. Maybe they hate a subject or there's a teacher that they don't like. How can we both validate them and support them to do their best in school when they're starting to have negative feelings either some of the time or even all of the time?
So the first thing I just want to say is that kids complain a lot about school, and that is normal and expectable. And I don't think I really appreciated this until I started to have my own 3rd and 4th graders. But man, they complain a lot. Like they give a very detailed accounting of every injury and insult and frustration of the day when we see them. And it can give the impression that things aren't going well. I think that's rarely the case. I think most of the time what is happening is that our kids are amazing at school. They hold it together quite beautifully. They don't complain. They don't punch anybody in the face. They don't throw themselves on the floor as the day, you know, unleashes its various frustrations. And school is hard. School, like none of us could do our kids' school days, right? I mean, they are, you know, even in the best possible schools, they're sort of herded around in groups. They're made to do things they don't feel like doing. They got to sit next to a kid they would never choose. I mean, it's a long day and they do it day after day. And I think for a lot of kids, the way they manage it is they hold it together while creating a catalog of, you know, things that they are dying to tell us about. They get home, they unload the catalog as a way to feel better. And usually they're done. Usually that was the whole system, right? Like I'll be well behaved all day if I can keep a record of everything that I was well behaved through, even though I wanted to act differently. And then I can tell you about those things. And if you could say, and this is mostly what kids want, like, oh man, that stinks. Or yeah, that sounds like that's super annoying. The system's beautiful. Having, you know, read you the catalog, dumped my emotional garbage. I'm good to go. I'll go back in. I'll pick up a bunch of more garbage tomorrow and bring it home and tell you all about it. Like I think we want to just normalize that as actually a very adaptive process and not necessarily worry when kids are complaining and not necessarily try to offer them fix, you know, advice. They don't want that very often. They feel annoyed by that. But then for a deeper dive, one of the things, I have a new book called The Emotional Lives of Teenagers that came out in February of this year. And one of the metaphors I bring across in that book is that I think it's helpful for us to remember that school is like a buffet where we require kids to eat everything on the buffet. So as adults, we just go up to the buffet, get our favorite foods, come on back to the table. And with kids, we're like, okay, eat it all. Like you have to, you know, like fill your plate. And I think that's fine. I think kids should actually try it all. I don't think that's an issue. But I think we can neutralize, if we use food preference terms, we can neutralize the fact that they're not going to like it all. And that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. It just means that they didn't choose what's on their plate. And so I think to say to kids, you know, so let's say broccoli's not your favorite, you know, your kid's favorite. Say to them, look, I get that sometimes a class is going to feel like broccoli and other times a class is going to feel like ice cream. That's the nature of school. And what's broccoli this year, you might like more next year, you know, but for this year with this teacher, whatever's being served, it feels like broccoli. You got to eat it. But we're here to help. I can sit with you while you do that homework. You could have a couple bites of that homework and then eat some of the homework you do like, you know, I mean, like, but to make it in those terms where it's not like what's wrong with the kid or what's wrong with the teacher or what's wrong with the school, that not everything is your kid's favorite, I think keeps it at the right size.
Yeah, I can remember some classes I definitely felt broccoli about myself. So it's understandable. I wanted to tell a short story. So the girls in my neighborhood, they're in intermediate school. So like 6th through 8th grade, I've somehow become this like adult in their lives. They like to come over to our yard. We'll do fires with them. And the last time they came over, they all had cell phones. And it was really interesting because then I, as a parent that doesn't have kids as old as them, started asking what age they got the cell phones, what are the rules around the cell phones? Like I was just interested for my own parenting. So they gave me their answers. And I think like a lot of parents listening, my husband and I are hoping to hold out for quite a while still. But it's one of those things where I think it's easier said than done. So I'm really interested to hear your answer on how do we make sure that we are helping our young people cultivate a healthy relationship with not only technology, but then also social media. These girls already have Instagram, TikTok. It's surprising in a way, because I don't have kids that age. So I want to hear what you
think.
I'm
so glad. If you hadn't brought this up, I would have brought it up with you, because this is my favorite thing to talk about, talking to parents of younger kids, because so much of how this succeeds isn't how you set it up from the beginning. And so often I'm talking to parents of adolescents where like that horse went out of the barn ages ago. And it's very hard to walk things back. So I have very strong opinions on all of this. Okay. So first of all, delay, 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 right? As long as you can delay. And I will tell you, the reason to give a kid a phone is that they do need to communicate with somebody in a way that the phone alone makes possible. So it may be that you have a kid who, you know, starts taking the bus in the sixth or seventh grade, and it feels like important to you as a family to have a way to be in communication. Though some families are using Apple Watches and other forms to do this. That's a reason. In my family, so my daughters are 7 years apart. My 19-year-old's a freshman in college. My 12-year-old's a sixth grader. They are enormously close. And so my 12-year-old got a cell phone earlier than otherwise we would have, so she could have a direct channel for communicating with her sister. So that was why. So I would first, like, don't do it just to do it. Like, do it because you need it for some communication purposes with somebody. The second thing to say is, when you don't have to give them much, kids can get by on texting for a very, very long time. So the cell phone that my 12-year-old has, it's an iPhone, because we're not going to keep replacing it. There is no browser on it, and there are no social media apps. It is a texting, and she uses it for like playing some video games. That's it. That's all she can do with it. And she can tell the time. She can set an alarm. But it's very rudimentary. I mean, in many ways, it functions like a dumb phone, even though it is a smartphone. So then the question becomes, when will she get social media apps? And here's how I'm sizing this up, having been in this world for a long time. Social media is pretty problematic. Not always, but it can be. And when it is problematic, it's really problematic. And I'd love to spend some time talking about like what constitutes problematic use of social media. Cause like there's also positive use of social media. And so, but there's risks involved with giving your kid social media, like no question about that. But social isolation is problematic too. Kids need friends. And kids need to be able to connect with their friends. So I actually said to my daughter the other day, I was like, she didn't ask, but I don't know why it came up. I was like, here's when you're going to get a social media app, when you can't maintain friendships without them. So long as you still have someone to hang out with, kids that you are connected with and can maintain those relationships over text, you're not getting social media. The only time I think it makes sense for kids to get social media, especially early adolescence, is if the entire universe of social activity is hinging on their ability to be aware of what's happening online and connect online over social media platforms. My goal as a mom is to see if my kid can't be 15 or 16 before that even feels like an issue. Because the difference between 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds being on those platforms and 15 and older is very, very big. The way their minds work is very different. Their understanding of how manipulative those platforms are is very different. Those are two, you know, slices of adolescence. You could get more fine-grained. And it's interesting, when I talk to high schoolers about social media, they're like, we're not the ones you need to be worried about. It's the seventh graders. And I actually think they're not wrong about that, which is not to say that the high schoolers aren't having their own impact from it that may not be all good. But they're helpfully more skeptical and aware of what's driving these large platforms. So I have more to say on this, though. I know this is a very long answer, but they're like, this is something I'm obsessed with. Okay. So one, hold up. Two, don't give them a phone with anything they don't need, and they mostly need texting. Three, I would strongly recommend that you make it a rule that it never enters the child's bedroom, ever. And I would also strongly recommend that all parents take their phones out of their rooms, especially at night. Your kid will agree to anything at the point when they want a phone. They will they just want it so badly that they will agree to anything. So go ahead and say, this thing never crosses the threshold of your bedroom door. The reason for this, first of all, it is so disruptive to have phones in rooms at night, even when we're asleep. It undermines the quality of the sleep we're getting. And then at night, like, it just keeps kids up. Sleep is a major factor for mental health. We know this. It's a major explanation for why mental health in teenagers looks so bad right now. Social media, digital technology is a major disruptor of sleep. So that's a reason. And then for the daytime, you know, like, it just feels squirrely to me. You know, like, I think at some level, your kids should not be doing anything on their phone that they wouldn't do in the living room, right? So Having them physically in the living room or the kitchen or whatever, I think just sort of is a constant reminder that this is not private. This is not secret. You're working in a public space when you're online. And I think part of how you kind of structurally remind kids of that is that, like, they use it in public spaces, that you don't go close a bedroom door and then spend hours and hours doing, you know, things without feeling like it's connected to a broader world.
Okay, so follow up to all of that, which I really appreciated that answer. I'm very interested in this topic, so I'm happy to spend time on it. So there were about 8 girls over. They were having a sleepover. All of them had cell phones, and they said everyone in their class has a cell phone. So it's interesting because in your answer, you're like, well, if the social sphere, that's the way that they communicate. Of course, these 8 girls were in person, so they obviously had that availability to be in person. But what if your child is telling you everyone else has the cell phone, mom? Like, this is not fair. Everyone else has it. What do we say in response to that?
Well, so one thing I'd be wondering is like, okay, well, what age are we talking? Because if you're talking 7th graders, not everyone has a cell phone.
6th through 8th grade was my sample set. Is 8 girls, and that's what they told me.
It's not true. But in some, but and then the degree to which it's not true will depend on different communities. So I live in the Midwest. We give our phones to kids a little bit later. You know, you go to the coasts, you see them much younger. So, you know, it may actually be true that, you know, a 6th grader on the coast may be telling the truth when they're like, I am the only kid without a cell phone, right? So I think some of it's regional and being aware of those regional differences. So there's a couple ways to slice it. One is to say, but you still have friends, right? You still have friends, and all the communication you need to do, you're able to do. So we're just going to wait a while longer. When you are suddenly hanging out with us on the weekends and you got nobody calling you, you know, through my phone or through the house phone, we'll revisit this. But you're able to socialize. And for now, we're just going to keep it in the 3D, you know, real world space. The other thing is you could just switch it over to, you could say, all right, well, then here's a phone that you can text on. Right. So I just think so often the error I see parents making, and it's not because it's not like a, it's an, it's just they don't know this world like I have had to know this world, is that when they give a kid their phone, they give them everything, you know, texting, browser, apps. You don't have to do it that way. You can go really, really slow and see how it goes. See how your kid handles having texting. I mean, if you give your kid texting and they end up in the meanest group thread ever, don't give them social media, right? I mean, like, you can kind of wade in here.
Meanwhile, I remember going into college and begging my parents for a cell phone. And I remember saying, but mom and dad, how am I going to connect with you if I don't have a cell phone at college? Obviously, a very different time. But I just remember those conversations so much and how it just wasn't a thing when we were growing up. So, and now it's definitely, definitely a thing.
Let's take a break from our podcast sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp has helped over 2 million individuals across the world, including Amy and I. They can help with everything from the minor setbacks that just seem so tedious day after day to the really big, hard, challenging life events that we don't want to face alone. What we love about BetterHelp is that it's so convenient. You're matched within 24 hours. You don't have to drive across town or wait in a cold waiting room. You can do everything from the comfort of your own home, or if you're like me, I get to go for a walk and talk to my therapist that way. You can really speak about anything. So just know that there's no topic that's off limits. And in the initial process, you're able to check the boxes on exactly what you want to go through. So if you go to betterhelp.com/herself, you also get 10% off your first month, making the convenient therapy even more affordable. Again, that's betterhelp, help.com/herself for 10% off. Remember that your mental health matters and you matter. Now back to our show.
And I like that we're talking about friendships here because you can have these friendships in real life. I also notice that a lot of times people will be in a big group and they're all texting other people that aren't even in the room. And sometimes I'm like, gosh, is this what our world has come to? But how can we start to demonstrate what healthy friendships look like? And even taking a step further, what these someday romantic relationships will look like? I'm really interested in hearing your response on this.
Usually kids just have good buddies. Like they can find a kid or two who they feel really good with. And that's a process that happens naturally. And with that, they don't need our help. You know, they just sort of find their way to it. Where they tend to need our help is when things aren't going well. And I think we should all plan on things not going well for our kids, kids coming into conflict with one another, kids feeling left out. You know, that's an inevitable aspect of growing up. And I think our job in those moments is to coach kids how to handle it well. So when kids come into conflict with one another, which they will, I think that we want to really talk with them about healthy and unhealthy forms of conflict. So the unhealthy forms of conflict, and this is something I spool out quite a bit in my book, Under Pressure. The unhealthy forms of conflict are the metaphors I like are like being a bulldozer, you run someone over, being a doormat, you let yourself get run over, or being a doormat with spikes, which is basically passive aggressive behavior, you know, like looking like you're okay with it, but actually not being okay with it. And doormat with spikes is so common that I even subdivide it into playing the part of the victim, using guilt as a weapon, or involving other people in what should actually be just a two-party discussion. So talk with kids. Like, these are the unhealthy forms of conflict you'll see in kids. You'll see them in adults. You'll see them in the media. And you'll see these everywhere. We don't do these. If you're going to have a conflict with somebody, you're going to do it as a pillar. You're going to be respectful of them, respectful of yourself, you know, assertive. You're going to raise the issue while still being kind and polite to them. Or you're going to drop it, right? Sometimes the right thing to do is somebody's mean to you and you know that they are, no matter what you say, they're going to bulldoze you or doormat with spikes you. Just drop it. And if they keep coming after you, we'll figure out what you need to do. But reacting to everything is not a good idea. So just really having, you know, kind of sleeves rolled up conversations about like, this is what it means to handle conflict well, but not being freaked out about the conflict itself. Then there's issues of just kids feeling hurt, you know, in relationships, whether they, you know, feel left out or they want to be part of a group that actually isn't taking new members or isn't taking them. And I think a lot of that is around emotion regulation. You know, the life is painful at times. And I don't think we want to be too frightened of that as their parents. I think that kids are reading us for how concerned they need to be about anything. And if we're pretty flipped out about the fact that their feelings got hurt in a social interaction, it's going to make the whole thing seem much scarier and more dangerous to them than it needs to. Whereas if we say, I'm really sorry that happened. And if you want to talk about it, I'm here for it. If you want to just figure out what will help you feel better, I'm here for that too. But sort of take it in stride and see our job as, you know, coaches on managing feelings, finding ways to express them, finding ways to tame them. I think that that's what emotional distress really offers us as parents, is opportunities to help kids just handle painful experiences. I do think that there, you know, is an interesting place here about the romance side, right? You're asking. So the first thing I want to say, we've studied this forever. You'll start hearing about this by the fifth grade. And that has been true historically. Like, this isn't like kids today. Like, usually by age 10, like there's like romantic chatter in a class. And usually it's kind of darling in its way. You know, like people decide that so-and-so is a couple and then they talk a great deal about it. The couple themselves may not be into it or even having conversations, but you know, that's not unusual to start in the fifth grade. What we see when we look at the research is that whether or not your kid has a romance in adolescence, you know, so starting, you know, at any point in adolescence, doesn't tell us a whole lot about their ultimate romantic relationships and the quality of them. What actually tells us about the quality of romantic relationships is the quality of the friendships your kid has. So keep an eye on how your kid is doing socially. And here's exactly what we want to see. We want to see with like younger adolescents that they can stand up for themselves, that they just don't take mistreatment from people, that if someone's unkind to them, they either distance themselves or they say something. We want to see with middle adolescents, so 13, 14, we want to see kids having a skill set around not allowing people to treat them badly. By 15, 16, we want to see that they actually can really have deep friendships, meaningful friendships, that they can actually share about things that feel substantial. And this is, you know, sophomore, junior year of high school. And we really expect to see that age that kids can connect about things that are very meaningful, you know, beyond just like being on the same team or whatever, but like much more meaningful things. And by 17, 18, what we want to see is that they can actually maintain friendships over time, that they have friends that they've had for a couple of years. year at least. So those are the benchmarks you're looking for developmentally. Stand up for themselves, be able to have a deep relationship, be able to have a lasting relationship. If you're seeing those, chances are your kid's going to go on to have great romances, because it really is. Those are all the skills that are necessary for a healthy romance. So your kid may not date at all. That's fine. Much more interested in sort of observing the quality of the friendships they have as they age.
That was such an interesting answer for me, because I didn't know that until you said it. So thank you for that one. In your book, you say, if we really want boys to get comfortable talking about their feelings, then the men in their lives should not leave the emotional work to women. Many of our listeners know I'm raising three boys, you know, a lot of people raising boys out there. And it gets hard because our listeners are mostly women. And so we're taking all of this in, and a lot of people are thinking, why isn't my partner listening to this? So those that are in a relationship with a man, how do we get them to know how important this is?
It's really important. And it's something that I had not thought a lot before I wrote this book. And then looking at the research, it really came, you know, kind of blazing across to me. So here's the deal. A lot of boys by about fifth grade are starting to consolidate a sense of masculinity, trying to figure out what it means to be a guy. And it's not at all unusual for them to decide that part of, you know, kind of, it's stereotyped, but it is often what they're saying or seeing. You know, being a guy means being invulnerable, being tough, not, you know, admitting any sense of weakness. And that all that feelings talk, that's for girls, right? That they start to build this view of what it means to be male or female. And then if in their daily experience, the only person who's asking about or talking about feelings happens to be the females in their life, like, so let's say in this case, their mom. And let's say, you know, that there are men around, right? Their father or other, you know, men who could, you know, serve in the role as sort of helping to raise this boy. If those guys are never mentioning emotions, and it's the women, the, you know, their sisters or the female classmates or their mom who are the ones who are mentioning emotions only, boys are like, see, my point has been proven. Like, this is truly for girls. And so I really feel for moms in this who are trying to raise emotionally attuned boys, because they're a little bit stuck, because if they are the only ones who are getting into these conversations, they actually risk confirming exactly the thing that they're trying to prevent. So let me just say right here, there are a lot of moms who are raising boys alone who are doing a phenomenal job of raising, you know, incredibly verbally adept and attuned boys. Like, there's no question about it. But we cannot have the default in our society be that this is women's work to talk about feelings. And it is critically important that if we want boys to feel that talking about feelings, being interested in other people's feelings, is something that's an inherently masculine thing, then the men in their lives also need to be doing it in front of them and with them too.
Amy and I are in a group of friends and we have a lot of boys. So that answer is just, it hits home. We definitely know how important it is. And it's also just a good reminder to be able to let them speak up and let them step in as dads or as father figures or as men in their life as well. And I also have a daughter, and I know that you wrote an entire book just on raising girls. And we know that it's hard, like whether you're raising girls or boys, there's a lot of things that we need to think about, but for the people in the audience that have babies, toddlers, early school agers, what are some of these age-appropriate conversations that we can be having with them when it comes to body autonomy and then also self-respect?
So that's right. So I wrote Untangled, which is about adolescents and teenage girls, though 80% of it applies to kids of all genders. And then actually I wrote another book called Under Pressure about stress and anxiety in girls, but that also 80% applies to kids of all genders. And then this most recent book about the emotional lives of teenagers, which is the title, which is all teenagers. You can start conversations about consent with kids of any gender very, very young. You can start conversations where you talk about, you know, can I put my hands you know, can I fix your swimsuit? Right. I mean, you can ask, you can make requests, before just jumping in there and grabbing, which we do as parents, like, I'm just going to adjust this real quick. And so I think those kinds of things where you ask, you know, would you like this? Or, you know, can Uncle Bill, can he give you a hug? You know, like, I mean, there's easy ways that we can start to, just in the day in, day out of family life, make it clear, like, kids have a right to their body and they have a right to decide who encroaches upon their space. I will also say, as the mother of, you know, two kids, like, you can also use lots of examples in family life, like, get your hands off of him or get your hands off of her. Like, I mean, kids rough and tumble all the time. And you can use sibling activity as a way to say, like, you know what? You don't get to do that. Like, you don't get to violate anybody's space like that, you know, and don't let anybody violate your space like that. I mean, so sibling life provides probably 400 opportunities a day for these conversations. So I think that you can really start just weaving it into the day in, day out of family life about, you know, our bodies are ours. Our bodies are sacred. We have choice and say about what happens with them, you know, and that family life interactions give us lots of very low-key ways to bring this up. And then as kids age, you can still use sort of displaced, you can start to use displaced examples. So like if you're listening to the radio and, you know, there's a song on and it's a little bit tawdry, which sometimes happens, you can be like, whoa, you know, okay, it sounds like that's what he wanted. Is that what she wanted? You know, I mean, you can actually use those examples that are not too on, you know, like, kids don't feel like they're the ones who are in the spotlight. And, you know, any self-respecting teenager will probably roll their eyes when you do that. And that's totally fine. The point has been made. You're, you know, you're making it clear that this is something that continues into, you know, life well beyond sibling interactions, you know, interactions with other people, that you have say and what you want matters. So you can weave it in without it being too heavy-handed at any given moment.
And it sounds like you can start that really at any age. So well before the teenage years, we can start to have those conversations.
Absolutely. I mean, you can say to a four-year-old, you know, do you mind if I got to adjust your overalls. Do you mind if I get in there and do it? Right. I mean, you can say that to a four-year-old. You don't have to put any broader context around it, but you're still asking for permission.
And then on the same lines, I know this question can be for boys or for girls, but I personally have a daughter who's in first grade who is so self-confident. She loves herself, but she also loves crop tops. So like, she likes to show off her body as well. So where is this balance, or how can we start to balance this self-esteem and not, you know, raining on her parade when it comes to her self-confidence, but then also modesty when it comes to these kiddos, especially when they're just so young?
Oh, this is like the most complicated question in the world. And it's one that has actually transformed pretty dramatically, I would say, in the last 5 to 10 years. That if we're talking about teenagers, which we're not, but just, and I'll come back to how to think about this with a six-year-old. If we're talking about teenagers, if you push back on what a teenage girl is wearing, you should totally be prepared for her to make a pretty powerful argument that this is her empowerment to display her body any way she wants. And if that's a problem for somebody else, that's their problem. This is fascinating, right? And I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's definitely different from even 5 to 10 years ago. Now with a six-year-old, I think that, and I can already see the limitations of this argument, but I think that part of what you make with a six-year-old is just a case about, like, which clothes do we wear where? You know, that there's different clothing that we wear to different places, right? So, you know, if you all go to church, you've got outfits that you wear to church that you're only, you know, there's things you're not going to wear to church, right? Or if you have a job interview, there's things that you are going to wear to the job interview and things you're not going to wear to the job interview. If you're going to the beach, you know, so I think that with six-year-olds, you can sort of have the, like, clothing is driven by context. Often we want to be wearing clothing that's appropriate to the context. And if you felt so inclined, you probably could, with a six-year-old, get away with saying, you know, crop tops, summer, beach, not school, right? And she'll say, yeah, but then 14 other kids are wearing crop tops at school. And you'll say, okay, well, this is my view of it. We're going to go with my view for now. You know, but that will, you're going to lose ground fast. So the other way to think about it is truly giving them a sense of, like, the parameters of what amount of coverage you think they should have for a given situation. And then they have to figure out how they're going to make it happen. So less about displaying the body and more about, this is for when kids want to go outdoors in shorts and it's very cold. I mean, I think that that's such an interesting, and I would say kind of constant negotiation as a parent, where you can say, like, I would recommend you wear something that's going to keep you warmer. They're not always going to be on board with that. I think then you have to decide, are you going to bring the extra item with you? Or are you going to let them face the natural consequences? I think the question of kids and their clothing is such a fascinating one in family life. And I think occasionally we have to put our foot down. If you're going to church, there, that may be a time when you have more say.
Yeah, Lucy has given us a lot of content. She'll like sneak a crop top to school by having something over it. And so in a sense, it feels like she knows that at school she can't wear that, but there's still that temptation to do it. So it's been interesting to witness as a friend of the mom. Dr. Lisa, this conversation has been so jam-packed. We want you to let everyone know where they can find more of you.
Thank you. So I have a podcast called Ask Lisa, the Psychology of Parenting. And our questions all come from listeners, and our listeners tend to be parents of teenagers and older kids. So we occasionally get a younger kid question, but I would say we center more of our content on it. I do it with my fabulous co-host, Rena Ninen, who's a journalist. And we're in three seasons. And so there's a huge archive of questions that we've answered as well. And then I have a website, drlisademore.com, that has a huge number of resources that are hopefully organized in a way that are easy for you to find what you're looking for if there's a need that you have. And then I have this new book, The Emotional Lives of Teenagers, that came out in February, and then two previous commercial books, Under Pressure and Untangled. And I'm also on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. So I try to make myself available in lots of ways. And I'm just so grateful to you for having me on.
Well, we are so grateful to you. And if you guys liked this interview, I would say go over and listen to one of her episodes. I think there's just going to be so much good information to take in. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. And I wanted to ask a little favor. If you have been enjoying the Herself podcast, and if it has made an impact in your life, we would love to ask you to help us in return. And the ways that you can do that are to go to wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. Just taking the time to share words of why other people might want to listen to this podcast really helps us get in front of more eyes. While you're there, also just hit the follow or subscribe button so that we land into your podcast inbox every single Monday. You will never miss an episode, and then also it helps us in our downloads. So again, thank you so much for doing those things, and we will talk to you next week.